Welcome to Oslo International Church's podcast, where we share weekly reflections from our community of faith. If you'd like to explore more of our resources or join us for a service, visit our website at oslointernational.church. And now, here's the message from our last Sunday service with Pastor Maikon Stornagel.
As you heard earlier today, when we were praying for our new OIC board, we had our General Assembly this week. And it was really nice to see many of you join and to hear the stories and reports from the different ministries. But it's not really the General Assembly or annual report that I want to talk about. I'm mentioning it because some of you might have read what I wrote in the introduction to the report. We have this annual report where we bring it all together and have a look at the year before. And some of you might have read what I wrote in the introduction about this little story that the gospel writer Mark tells us about Jesus and a little girl on her deathbed. And that story came to me this week as I was thinking about the board thing and all of those things, and it stuck with me. It stuck with me. And sometimes a good story does that, right? Sometimes a good story does that. It sticks with you, and it just won't let you go. And this is the story that Mark tells. Now, Jesus had just landed on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, crossed it, the boat with his disciples, just landed on the shore, and this crowd surrounds him. It's full of people, and somebody approaches him. And it is one of the leaders of the synagogue, and this means that this was a fairly important man in the local community. And this man, and Mark tells us that his name was Jairus, he approaches Jesus, and he approaches Jesus because he is desperate. And he is desperate because his daughter is on her deathbed. Sick beyond the help that their understandings and practices of healing at the time and place could give her. And he can see that she's on her way to go. His little girl is about to die. And this man pleads that Jesus hurry to his house, to his sick daughter, and that Jesus do whatever he can do to help her. Now, Mark doesn't tell us what Jesus says. He just tells us that Jesus went with him. And Mark also tells us that Jesus seemed less in a hurry than Jairus' despair asked for. So surrounded by a crowd as he goes, Jesus stops in the middle of the way to try and find, in the middle of all the people in this crowd, to find a single woman who had been suffering for over a decade with a continuous blood discharge and whom had been healed by the manner in which she dares to approach and touch Jesus. And that's another wonderful story, which I would love to talk about, but we don't have the time to go into it today. But that story slows down Jesus, right? And his lack of urgency, it comes at a cost. And then we get to what I want to read with you today, which is in the Gospel of Mark, Chapter 5, and I'm going to read from verses 35 to 43. And this is what Mark tells us. While he was still speaking, some people came from the leader's house to say, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the leader of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." He allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the house of the leader of the synagogue, he saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. When he had entered, he said to them, "Why do you make a commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. Then he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talita kum," which means, "Little girl, get up." And immediately the girl got up and began to walk about. She was 12 years of age. At this, they were overcome with amazement. He strictly ordered them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. Now, it's a well-known story. If you grew up in church and are familiar with the stories from the Bible, I knew it well. But this is what caught my attention and what stuck with me about the story this week. This little girl had been lying in what all had assumed was her deathbed. And then Jesus holds her hand and talks to her. And I find that, isn't that amazing? He talks to her. To her, right? He talks to this girl that is presumed dead. Not over her. Right? Not about her, but he speaks to her. And this is such an intimate thing that Mark makes sure that we know that he speaks. It's one of those instances in which he says he is speaking in her language. Right? He speaks to her in her language, Talita koum. And this is no magical formula. This is no fireworks. This is no mysterious spell. This isn't some kind of prayer with words of power. All that this means is, little girl, get up. Talita koum, little girl, get up. And this is what got me. This is the beauty of it all. While everyone was busy with the amazement of her, in fact, getting up and walking around, Jesus is still with her. Truly with her. And this is what Jesus says. Give her something to eat. Give her something to eat. Isn't that amazing? This girl just came back from the dead, and Jesus' reaction is to say, give her a snack, okay? And that's the thing that amazes me about Jesus. He is not concerned or dazzled by the miracle in itself. Jesus is busy with the living. He's busy with the living. Right? He holds her hand not to make a spectacle out of her, not to make a point out of her resurrection, but because he wants her to live. And to live, a little girl needs to eat. And she needs to drink, and she needs to play, and she needs to laugh, and she needs to sing, and she needs to sleep without fear of not waking up. Little girl, get up. Right? Little girl, let's get on with the living. Let's get on with the living. This story and this Jesus reaction in it, while everybody is fussing about the miracle, he is busy with the living. He's already going, right? It stuck with me, and I realized it wasn't only because of the report that I had been working on, and all the things that I've been thinking about, but because it spoke also into another story that I had started talking about last week and that I'm going to continue talking about today, which we have actually been talking about for 3 weeks now, which is the story of Joseph, the son of Jacob, which is told in the first chapter, the first book of the Bible, in the book we call the book of Genesis. And if you're not familiar with the story of Joseph, in a nutshell, Joseph is one of the sons of Jacob, which is one of the patriarchs of the Israel story, right? And Jacob has 12 sons, all said and done. At this point, he has 11. But he has a lot of kids. But Joseph is his favorite, right? And he makes it clear that Joseph is his favorite. So, of course, his brothers aren't too happy about it, right? And then Jacob goes on and actually gives Joseph a special coat with these beautiful long sleeves to mark him out as the favorite. And to make things worse, Joseph is not really, he doesn't have street smarts. He has these dreams about his brothers and his mother and father bowing down to him. And he goes around and tells everybody, hey, I had these dreams. And this creates hatred. This creates anger. This creates misgiving between Joseph and his brothers, to the point that one day when they have the opportunity, they decide to get rid of Joseph. And they decide they're going to kill him, but one of the brothers doesn't sit well with him, so they try to stop it. In the end, what they end up doing is they sell Joseph as a slave to a caravan of Midianites that is going by. And Joseph is taken as a slave. They get his robe, the beautiful, nice papa boy robe, tear it apart, dip it in blood, bring it to Jacob. What do you think, Jacob? Jacob assumes Joseph is dead, right? Maybe you heard the story. Joseph ends up in Egypt as a slave, ends up in the house of a guy named Potiphar. He does well in the house of Potiphar, is put as a manager, still a slave as a manager. Then his wife, the wife of Potiphar, decides she wants to have Joseph, and she's not happy with this immigrant slave not going to bed with her when she wants him. So she makes up a scene and gets Joseph thrown into prison. Joseph loses everything again and is put in prison. But then in prison, he does well. The manager of the prison puts him in charge. And at one point, he is called before the Pharaoh because this thing with dreams that Joseph has, even though he's not very smart in who he tells or who he doesn't, he is actually quite smart in interpreting dreams. And he's brought before Pharaoh, who has this dream. He interprets Pharaoh's dream, and because of that interpretation, he is put as a governor over the whole of Egypt. And Joseph's dream, or the Pharaoh's dream that Joseph interprets, has to do with a coming famine in the land of Egypt. There's going to be a time of plenty, then a time of famine, and the Pharaoh says, just handle this, Joseph. Rule Egypt in my stead. Handle this situation. Okay, that's what Joseph does. The famine comes. It's way beyond Egypt. It reaches the family of Joseph in Canaan, and his brothers come down to Egypt to buy grain because the only place that has grain is Egypt because of Joseph's administration. They come before Joseph without knowing. Joseph recognizes them. And then there's this back and forth, right, in which Joseph is nice to them, but then puts them in a tight spot and makes them think that they're going to get into trouble. And they keep on doing this with the grain until at one point, Joseph reveals himself to them, says who he is, brings them actually back from Canaan into Egypt, and he gives them land, and he takes care of them, and he meets his father again, and it's a beautiful story, right? But last week, we talked about this story to talk about forgiveness. And what we were talking about last week is the importance of understanding forgiveness, or of going into a deeper understanding of forgiveness that is not about giving the perpetrator a pass, but it is about daring to not replicate the cycles of destruction and sin, daring to not repeat the model of the violence and the evil that was done against us. And in the story of Joseph, this plays out in that Joseph, instead of giving a payback, he refuses to play that game at some point. We're going to get a bit back to this, right? Because there's some back and forth. But he doesn't pay back or forward for the evil that was done to him. He doesn't do it in the house of Potiphar. He had the chance. He doesn't do it when he's a governor of Egypt, but he chooses rather to take another path, to believe in the possibility of life, and create possibilities, right? A different way of understanding forgiveness that is daring to believe that other realities are possible that don't replicate these cycles, that we don't need to do an eye for an eye. And the story of Joseph is a powerful witness, I think, to this understanding of forgiveness, right? As daring to believe in the possibility of a path that doesn't repeat the example and the model of those and that which has caused harm and pain and destruction. But as we come to the end of the narrative of the story of Joseph in the book of Genesis, we find a rather peculiar development. And it's in the very end of the book of Genesis, chapter 50, and I want to read it with you from verse 15 to 21. This is what the story tells us. Jacob had died, the father, right? And this is what it says. Realizing that their father was dead, Joseph's brothers said, "What if Joseph still bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong that we did to him?" So they approached Joseph saying, "Your father gave this instruction before he died. Say to Joseph, I beg you, forgive the crime of your brothers and the wrong they did in harming you. Now, therefore, please forgive the crime of the servants of the God of your father." That's what they say to Joseph. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also wept, fell down before him and said, "We are here as your slaves." But Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? Even though you intended to do harm to me, God intended it for good in order to preserve a numerous people as he is doing today. So have no fear. I myself will provide for you and your little ones." In this way, he reassured them, speaking kindly to them. I said this development in the story is peculiar, but perhaps it's not so much that it is peculiar, but that it is one of those uncomfortable realizations. One of those uncomfortable moments in which we realize that we have to deal with something that we had been avoiding. But why might we call this part of the story peculiar anyway? Well, because the narrators of the story had given us many reasons in between chapter 45 and now, this is chapter 50, many reasons to believe that this whole issue between Joseph and his brothers was sort of water under the bridge. The way the narrative goes gives us the impression that, well, okay, now it's solved. We had a grand closure, and all is good. The alternative reading for today in the lectionary was from Genesis 45, five chapters before this. And it tells the story of Joseph's great reveal, right? When he finally discloses to his brothers that he is Joseph, whom they sold into slavery, and where he in fact quite clearly says in chapter 45, he says, "Do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." That's what he says when he finally tells them who he is. And then he goes ahead and he tells them to bring over their father Jacob. And as I said before, he gives them land in Egypt and provides for them in a time of hunger and need. So one would think that the issue is solved and that all has been forgiven. But Joseph's brothers, they obviously don't think so. And when their father dies, the demons of their own fears and of their unaddressed issues, they come back to life. What if Joseph had only acted with kindness out of his love for Jacob and for his brother Benjamin, who had nothing to do with the whole selling their brother into slavery affair? What if this was vengeance time? What if Joseph had just been biding his time? Or what if The anger and the resentment had just been festering. And now it was going to burst. And honestly, we like painting Joseph as a big hero because we like heroes. But Joseph had given them enough reasons for considering this possibility to be reasonable. If you know the story, you can think about how he plays with them and manipulates the situation when they first come to Egypt. He knows who they are. They don't know who he is. He keeps on making them think they're going to go to prison or be killed all the time. And he does this back and forth with keeping one of them in prison, sending the other one away until they're hungry enough to come back. And then he does the whole thing. And he uses the power he has to manipulate them until the point in which he can't handle it anymore. And then he does his big speech of, you know, it's going to be okay. And again, Joseph was a powerful man. Think about how the story tells us that he made all of Egypt slaves to Pharaoh in their hunger. So it doesn't seem like Joseph was a man who had the qualms of doing whatever he put his mind to. And then there's something else, right? A little detail when we read this is that we suddenly realize that this is the first time that his brothers actually say out loud that what they did to Joseph was a crime and that they ask for his forgiveness. In chapter 45, they don't. Joseph is the one who says, "Don't think about that. I will take care of you." But there's no moment here before now in which they actually confess to what they have done so that they may be forgiven. And even now, right, they do it mixed with what seems to be a lie regarding the words of Jacob. And this is why I said that the thing with this story is perhaps not so much that it is peculiar, but that it is one of those uncomfortable realizations. And it is the realization that forgiveness and reconciliation and healing are not per se the same thing. We hinted at this last week, right? That forgiving doesn't enforce change on the perpetrator or on the system. It allows for change. It believes in the possibility of change. It doesn't force it, and it doesn't make it necessary come about. And it's important, there's something here that's important to understand as well, is that when Joseph says that what their brothers did was used by God to bring about good, he is not saying that what they did was okay. It would be very wrong to understand this story as being, well, then, great that he was sold into slavery. He's not saying that what they did was okay. He's saying that what they did, God brought about into something of goodness. And the preacher and scholar named Cameron Howard makes a commentary on this, and I think she hits the spot when she's writing on the story, and she says, just as the one who is wronged has the power to forgive, the one who is wronged also has the power to make this kind of theological proclamation. If a sufferer sees divine purposefulness in his or her suffering, we can affirm or at least hear out that declaration. We dare not, however, try and explain away another person's suffering with our own theological speculation. Right? So Joseph can say, I have come to understand the circumstances of my life as having brought about good. And then he can be affirmed in that. But we can't turn that around to say then that what his brothers did was justified. And what this story at the end of the story of Joseph is reminding us is that transformations and forgiveness are for the sake of the living. Are for the sake of the living. They're not They don't do much if they are for the sake of solving some kind of mystical bureaucratic issue. They are for the living. So we still have to carry on with the business of living and what that entails. In a sense, coming back to life is the easiest part of resurrection. The real work is living. That's when it gets tricky. Give the girls something to eat, right? Get on with the business of living. Now she gets to grow. What does that look like? Now, don't get me wrong. Sometimes forgiveness, and again, I talked about this last week. If you want to, you can hear the podcast, which we will publish this week. We're a bit late with that. But if you want to hear more about that, sometimes forgiveness is an extremely difficult thing. But we need a gospel and a faith, and we are given, I believe, a gospel and a faith that is committed to the living. And this is where things like reconciliation come into place. Paul talks a lot about that. And we see it different places. We see it here in the Gospel of Joseph. There needs to be a work of realizing the consequences of things and finding ways of dealing with them with each other. This is where things like reconciliation take place. There can be forgiveness without reconciliation, and it can set free the person who forgives. But as a community of faith, we want to work towards the possibility of works of reconciliation. This is where things like reparation come into place as well. Or therapy, right? Or healing in the areas that were broken by these things. And that's the work of living, right? This is also where community comes into place. Not just standing around and saying, well, we need to forgive, but being part of the business of living so that there can be healing and life and possibilities, so that that courage to believe that there can be another way finds embodiment and ground to become something that is something other than what the hurt would have caused and made be, right? So when our understanding of forgiveness is limited to an action, every misstep is a failure, right? But if our understanding of forgiveness and reconciliation is deeper, then they are part of living and they don't diminish, they welcome us into the reality of redemption, which is beyond that. And I believe we need a gospel and a faith that is committed to that reality of redemption. We need a gospel and a faith that is committed to the living, to restoration, to reconciliation, to justice, to change of character, to new ways of understanding God's revelation in our life today so that it can bring healing and possibilities. And that is what I echoed in my spirit as I heard those words of Jesus to that little girl. Such simple words, right? Talita ko'um. Get up, little girl. And then give her something to eat. Because that is what I see in Jesus and the community that he sets in motion. That's the call. The ones who dare to believe in that moment in which life can break through, even though everything seems like death, but then who insist on life, who grab life with both hands and say, we will nurture life. We will be part of the business of living. We're going to not only dare to believe that these cycles of, of violence, of revenge, or of anger, of resentment, that they can be broken. But we will also put our hands, hearts, words, prayer, theology, community living to the service of nurturing these other possibilities. And that is a practice, a daily practice, just like eating, to keep our bodies healthy. I find it more and more as I grow older, I think this thing with the sacraments resonates, right? And with the Holy Communion. We're going to take Holy Communion today. We need to come back to it, to the possibility of forgiveness in life and to the possibilities that that opens up. To grace and to hope. To the reality of blood that is shed and bodies that are broken, being subverted and reconfigured by the reality that life in God never ceases and can even flourish and become life abundant. That's a hard thing to do, but it's a needed thing to do, and it's a thing we do as a community. We insist on these things. Every day, when we raise from the different deathbeds we make for ourselves, we say, we're going to eat. We're going to insist on living. We're going to eat. We're going to take the body and blood of Christ. We're going to insist on forgiving. We're going to dwell in the Spirit. We're going to insist on reconciling. We're going to look around and insist on loving. We're going to look inside and have the courage to do the work of healing. And I think there's something wonderful and extremely powerful and world-transforming of having a God who expresses that in such a concrete way as the God incarnate, as Jesus Christ. Our hope, our strength, our daily bread. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face shine upon you, that you may know that he is gracious towards you. May the Lord turn his face towards each and every one of you and bring you of his peace. So go in the peace of our Lord Jesus Christ and serve each other, serve the world, serve the Lord joyfully. Amen.
Do you want to stay connected with us? Check out our website at oslointernational.church to discover more about our community, access additional resources, and join us in our faith journey. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.